Welcome to Paper Team, a podcast about television writing and becoming a TV writer. I'm Alex Friedman, aka TV Calling.
And I'm Nick Watson on Twitter and underscore NJ Watson.
And on this month's Paper Scraps, we'll be discussing your TV writing questions about being an assistant, access, and supporting yourself financially. Plus, we'll be talking about the latest TV writing news, including the Paramount Plus presentation and the latest exposés. Let's get started.
Before we get into your TV writing questions, we did want to mention a review that we received for the podcast from Tim Hume, titled The Best Podcast for TV Screenwriters. And Tim says, if you want to be a screenwriter for television in Los Angeles, this is what you should be listening to. Alex and Nick give you all the information you need in a podcast that is fun to listen to. I know what you're thinking, and sure, you can listen to John and Craig if you want to write features, but this is the podcast for your TV screenwriting needs. I've listened to a bunch, like a bunch. Go try the others. Hey, why not? But when your life gets busy and you don't have time for them all, this is the one that you will go to first. Thank you, Tim. That's very high praise and we appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much for your listenership. It's been a while since we've read a reviews on air, so it's good to hear from our listeners.
That always brings a smile to our face, so thank you very much.
All right, let's get into your own TV writing questions. We got a multi-part email from Brian who emailed us saying, hi, I just graduated NYU and I'm hoping to get an assistant job, then hopefully a writer. What has your journey been like? When it comes to being an assistant, do you enjoy the work? As I'm also hoping to staff one day, I'd love to hear how one can make that push. In the years you've been an assistant, how often have you tried to make that push? Do you feel like you're networking enough? I just want to gain as much insight as I can so I get a rough idea on how to proceed. I know Hollywood is extremely unpredictable, but I just love to hear about experiences from others. Hope you have a good day.
Yeah, that's definitely a big question to tackle, Brian, but I'm more than happy to take a stab at it. My suspicion is that you may have just started the podcast and maybe the first batch of episodes that were 5 years ago, back when we were still working as assistants and that kind of thing. And in fact, if you continue to listen through, you're going to hear a lot about our journey and how we've kind of gone from place to place and the struggles we've had and how you can kind of make that jump from being an assistant to a writer. But happy to go into some detail here in this response.
Exactly. It's sort of hard to really summarize 200 and plus episodes in just a few sentences, because this whole journey and our own evolution, as well as some of our listeners' evolution, has been chronicled throughout this podcast. That said, I'm sure we can tackle some of those questions. Our own journey is pretty unique. I feel like everybody has their own unique path, so it's hard to be prescriptive about the way you should be doing certain things. We are both immigrants, so even our own perspectives as immigrants is different than someone who is from the U.S. or even graduated in the U.S. I think NYU is a great school, and one of the biggest opportunities you have if you are in an American school, especially an American school doing film school, is the alumni network. And it's something that personally I've never had, really, as being an immigrant from Europe and obviously went to a French university, not an American or English university by any means. And so moving here, I didn't have that alumni network that people who go to university here, at the very least, have that opportunity. So that's definitely something to be aware of.
Yeah, definitely. Talk a little bit more about that in our early episodes. But on the question of kind of being an assistant and whether we enjoyed that work, it really depends. It depends on the job. It depends on the people you're with. I think in general, no one wants to be an assistant forever. You're not doing it because the assistant work itself is incredibly fulfilling and it's something that you would just kind of do on your own anyway. But it provides you so many opportunities to learn, to get to witness firsthand the creative process, to get to meet other writers and creatives and people who work in film and TV. And I think that there certainly are parts of it that are quite enjoyable in that process, but there are also many things like the long hours, the low pay, the stress that come with it that make it not the best job in the world, to be perfectly honest.
Exactly. I feel like it really depends on what kind of assistant position you speak about and where you end up working. One thing you can definitely control, you can definitely control the type of assistant positions you're trying to get, and you can sort of control where you end up. But the second half is, you know, as soon as you enter a room that doesn't value upward mobility, for example, that's not something you can really know until you're in the thick of it. You can definitely ask other assistants and get an idea of upward mobility, but it's definitely a question that you won't get the answer to until you're in the thick of it. Now, in terms of enjoying the work, I mean, I definitely believe that everyone who wants to be a TV writer, everyone who wants to break in, quote unquote, should be an assistant, at least for several years. Whether it's a writer's assistant, a script coordinator, a writer's PA, agent's assistant, et cetera, that's up to your own goals and your own thoughts and what you want to learn from this business. But being an assistant isn't just about assisting someone. It's also about exposing yourself to other areas of the industry that as soon as you work on the higher echelons, you're not really aware of. And in fact, you take some things for granted, which will make you a terrible boss. And so all those things you should be learning as an assistant, not, you know, in the thick of it as being a boss, for example, or even being a staff writer. And those are the kinds of experiences you don't really get unless you've lived through those things.
Yeah. In terms of bridging that gap between being an assistant and being a staff writer, I would say it's less of a push, as you put it. It's less of this kind of particular moment where you decide, okay, now's when I'm going to be a writer. I think everybody who is an assistant thinks that they would like to be and could be a writer at any particular moment. Maybe there are some people who feel they want to get some more experience, but I think in order to want to do this job in this career, you have to have that belief in yourself that if you were put into the room, you could do it. It's less of a concerted push at some point where you decide, no, I'm ready to be a writer. And it's more of a gradual process of putting yourself out there, making your goals known to the people around you, doing the work, improving your writing to the best place it can be, having that stuff ready. And then when the opportunities come along, being prepared to put yourself up for that. And you're probably going to have to go through multiple times of being rejected or being overlooked before you get that first chance.
Right. It's not a binary process of saying, okay, now I'm on, I'm activated, TV writer mode activated. That's not how it works, practically speaking. It's a journey with different processes. And on top of that, I have a bit of a mixed feeling now about assistant work in that idea of doing assistant work for that upward mobility. It's something that we've talked about before. In fact, we'll revisit this topic momentarily in one of our other questions and other topics to cover. But I'm a bit on the fence about advising people to be assistants specifically with the goal of being a TV writer or a staff writer, for example. Obviously, being a writer's assistant or a script coordinator or a support staff in a room is probably one of the best ways to do those things. However, I think it's much more of a lottery now than it used to be because of a myriad of reasons that we've covered before, and I'm sure we'll cover momentarily again in this podcast. But overall, I just feel like you should be taking these opportunities because they're for you to take. And you should not reserve yourself from taking those opportunities, especially if your goal is to be a staff writer, if your goal is to be a TV writer. You should take those professional opportunities when they come at you, especially if it's the kind of experience you've never had before. It's better to have that experience than not have it.
Yeah, definitely. On the topic of how do you know you're networking enough, I don't know if there is a particular prescribed limit to the amount that you should be networking. I think there are definitely people who perhaps are not doing it at all, but there's also a level where you can be putting yourself out there so much that you are burning yourself out. You're not networking in the right ways. You're giving a bad impression to people that you feel like you're just sort of out there to get people's business cards and take advantage of them. So it's about finding that middle ground. And like we've said time and time again on this podcast, building genuine, meaningful relationships with people out there, friendships, mutually supporting each other in your goals, and allowing that to kind of take place over a period of years rather than having to kind of be the ultimate networker in order to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I would say if there's an actual quantifiable metric in terms of the limit for networking, it would be something akin to Dunbar's number. And if you're not familiar with Dunbar's number, it's sort of this cognitive idea that we only have a certain amount of people with whom we can maintain stable social relationships before every person is like anybody else, like a stranger, essentially. And that number kind of depends on each person. I think 150 is kind of roughly the number of stable relationships for Dunbar's number. But overall, I think the important part here is remember that networking isn't about practical realities of, okay, I'm going to create this transactional relationship with someone. It's about building this bridge, this social relationship with that person. And so that person, when there's an opportunity being opened, they think of you, for example, or they think that you might be right for the job and vice versa. You should be doing the same thing for other people. And so that's more about actual relationships and friendships and so forth, as opposed to that transactional idea of, okay, now I need to meet 100 executives before, you know, I have done enough networking in my life. That's not quite how it works. Much like any relationship, it's a moving target. It's not quite as easy as saying, oh, it's this number.
All of that is to say that, Ryan, your questions are very much the kinds of big questions that people have when they're first looking to get into TV writing. It's like, how do I do this in the first place? What's the best time and way to spend my energy? What kind of job should I get? All of that kind of thing. And again, that's kind of the purpose of this podcast. So we definitely recommend taking a browse through the 210 plus episodes that we have here and just finding the titles that are of interest to you and saying, oh, this one's about networking. Let me listen to the networking series. This one is about how to be the best assistant you can be and transition to staff writer. I think at this point, we've pretty much covered almost every topic you can imagine or have a question about. So that's the best way to get a little more info on those topics.
Absolutely. On that note, let's move on to some Twitter threads that caught our eyes recently in regards to TV writing. And one thread was from one of our former guests, James Hamilton, who did this whole Twitter thread regarding supporting yourself financially as a writer.
Yeah, so James has actually been doing a series of these Twitter threads recently. He did another one about the difference between writing for live action and animation. One, I think, about pitching. This is another one just recently, which was prompted by a question directed at him by Tuesday Simmer, who said, "Do you mind if I ask how you supported yourself during this time as a writer? It's something I struggle with. Do you just have a regular job?" So James went into kind of detail about his personal experience. You know, he wasn't trying to say everyone will experience this or have this. This is literally what I did, where I worked, how I was able to support myself financially to get to where I was. And I think kind of highlights that thing of everyone has a completely different experience, and it's totally normal to take random jobs to support yourself. I think James worked in an escape room for a while, being kind of an actor in that, to kind of get him through that period where the income was unreliable as a writer and performer.
I think all this is great advice to remind yourself that just because you want to be a TV writer or you are working towards being a professional writer doesn't mean you can be other things as well whilst you get to that goal, because really there's no goal. It's a journey, as we keep repeating. And the same holds true for your position, your job. If you want to support yourself financially, you should feel free to take those jobs, whether that's repeating an assistant position or taking an executive position or doing script reading or doing something completely different. Like you mentioned, James did an escape room. And I'm sure all those different experiences, especially in the industries that are not directly the same vertical as a TV writing industry, can still service your TV writing goals or your screenwriting goals. In this case, I'm sure James now has amazing stories in regards to managing or being in an escape room environment. And I'm sure that can make an awesome comedy for him to write if he so wants to. All your positions, all your experiences can service your career and your craft as well. And so it's important to be malleable in that way, as opposed to saying, okay, I'm only taking those specific jobs because they're only industry related, or because this is the one way I'm going to be a TV writer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people get very concerned with kind of appearances and ego as a writer, and you have to appear to be always succeeding. And even when you were coming out of college, oh, I won this competition and I did this and I was writing for such and such. And you kind of sculpt that image of yourself to people as someone who's just always been a successful writer or whatever. But, you know, I think that a big thing that we've kind of learned along this journey is that it is that unique experience, like Alex just said, that you draw upon to make yourself interesting as a writer. Working in an escape room, that's amazing. That's a great story to tell. James said he lived with his grandma for a while. There you go. That's another basis for story and comedy that you can draw from. In fact, I was just reading an article recently that a lot of writers have struggled creatively during this COVID pandemic because we're not going out and doing things and experiencing the world and having those things to inspire us and create from. We're just stuck in the same situation over and over, and that leads to a lack of creative energy and a lack of material for us to draw from. One in millions of people come straight out of college, get their first rep, get staffed on a show, and that's the only job they've ever done. That's not the case for pretty much everybody. So don't feel that you have to be, and embrace what makes you you.
All right, let's move on to our next Twitter thread.
Yeah, so the next thread that we have here is from Michelle Denise Jackson, who said, "I'm hearing from a lot of friends who are either trying to staff for the first time or trying to get their second staffing job that they're not even able to be submitted because shows are only now hiring upper-level writers or, and my other big gripe, not hiring staffs at all. This is really how I know so many of the gatekeepers, many of them white, in the industry were not serious about making things better after the reckoning this summer. POC, disabled, LGBTQ+, women writers are woefully underrepresented at all levels of the industry, but the root is we're not being given opportunities to staff and be promoted at the same rate as our white or straight or abled male counterparts. How can an industry become more inclusive and diverse if you're literally barring marginalized and underrepresented writers from the room?" She goes on to say, "If we're unable to get that first staffing job, it means that we are not able to begin working our way up the room hierarchy from lower level to middle level to upper level. And that means the writers who are also being hired at the upper level ranks are still those white, straight, able-bodied dudes. How is this acceptable to showrunners who claim to support more inclusive writers' rooms? How is this acceptable to studios who make a big public show of saying they're supporting these efforts to make their shows more inclusive and diverse?"
Right. So this topic is actually something we've covered before multiple times. In fact, 2 years, almost to the day, we did an episode called The Evolution of Access, PT 125 in March. That was the episode where I talked about one of the issues that is plaguing this industry, and it keeps happening, in fact, more and more. And that's what Michelle is talking about here, which is that lower level writers, lower level positions are disappearing. They're being reduced. And all the rooms now, more and more rooms, especially cable rooms, are top heavy to such an extent that they end up not having any lore levels, any staff writer levels, etc. In fact, we also did another episode called Less TV, Less Opportunity. That was PT 186 discussing all these issues, the trend of diminishing episode orders, shorter seasons, how that affects the size of writers' rooms, opportunities for emerging writers, and all those cascading consequences for television writing. And I think this thread is the perfect encapsulation of all those ideas, because ultimately it's not even, I mean, obviously it's about representation and so forth, but on a basic level, if you don't have upward mobility, if you don't have lower level position, then that's an existential threat to the capacity of anyone to become a TV writer, regardless of their creed, regardless of who they are, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem here is, one of the many problems is that those higher level positions, if you look at EPs especially, there are still 80% white male, basically. And so that's what we talk about here when we talk about opportunity. It's not just about the positions. It's also the lack of access to those positions and the lack of upward mobility. There's a bit of a bottleneck that happens around mid-level where you don't have those upward mobility potential. And now it's compounded by the fact that there's not even positions on the lower level. They don't even exist in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only is this a huge issue for underrepresented and diverse writers being able to get their way into writers' rooms and work their way up, as Michelle put so eloquently, if you're one of those people who is perhaps a white guy in the industry and feels, oh no, I can never get a staff writing job because they're only going to diverse writers, that's because of this problem too. The upper level white male writers are using diversity as an afterthought rather than genuine inclusion. And so they are just trying to tick off that box and hire a diverse staff writer and fire them the next year when they have to pay them more or whatever. So if we actually genuinely address this problem at its root, then the industry would be more equitable for everybody. And we wouldn't get these bottlenecks at certain areas that end up excluding writers from being able to get their way into the industry.
Exactly. And to that point, I mean, 2 years ago, again, in that episode, I mentioned the idea that, you know, I urged the WGA to look at mandatory staff writer positions, mandatory positions, lower level. In fact, now this is being echoed, and hopefully there's going to be some traction and some momentum soon. Now, my worry is that usually the guild is worried about, you know, the more top-heavy positions as opposed to the lower levels. And so because they're dealing with the top-heavy EPs and producers and all those people being overrepresented, so to speak, in those power positions in the guild, they have less of an incentive, at least they think they do, to represent those lower-level writers, when in fact it's the opposite, because lower-level writers are the future of the guild. They're the future of the industry. The other problem, obviously, is the fact that if you look at any show being produced or being made right now, roughly 80%, I've not done the math, but I would definitely say 85% of them are produced by the same dozen super producers. If you think about all the shows, all the movies being made, all the big ones, most of them are by the same dozen names or dozen production companies you can think of that are still rooted to the same one human being. And if you look at actual WGA numbers in terms of inclusion and diversity, those are not numbers we pull from thin air. Again, I'm looking at this breakdown right now from 2020. It's not from 50 years ago, it's from 2020. And it shows that showrunners, 70% men, 82% white. So that's just the shorter level. And that was last year. But if you look at the lower level position, it's much more equitable, where you see it's basically 50-50 men, women, 50-50 white and people of color. And so that's the bottleneck that exists, where at some point, some magical point towards the higher up, there's no upward mobility. It's the same people doing all the things, as opposed to giving opportunities to newer people, or at least mid-level people, for them to move up so that the lower level people can move up. And if you don't even enforce lower level positions, then you don't even have a future for this industry, which is really why we keep harping on this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of this comes down to these white male showrunners hiring people that, oh, they've worked with before and I know them and I trust them. And that's when all those upper level and mid level positions get filled out by other white dudes they've worked with, and then forces this bottleneck at the bottom and no one's moving up there. It also comes from studios who are unwilling to take risks, studios who want to remake the same IP every 3 years and attach somebody who's already done 20 years of procedural crime shows to run the same thing. And that's going to be a white guy, because that's the way the industry has been up until now, due to the various problems of access and equity. So until those showrunners and until the studios start getting to the root of meaningful change here, you know, the goal is in 20 years that we are seeing that level of diversity that we have at the staff writer and lower level positions actually translating to those upper level and showrunner positions. But right now, no one seems to be willing to actually give them that shot to move up in the first place. So if we don't do that, that's never going to happen.
Exactly. All this compounds on itself, right? It's not just one issue, it's everything with each other. So the fact that you have these super producers, super EPs hoarding all the credits at the top, and they're paid millions and millions and millions of dollars. With one of the super producers, you could pay, I don't know, 100 staff writers, right? Like, if you divide up that amount of money in terms of actual positions on the lower side of the spectrum, then you could get so many more opportunities. It's a bit like the 99% of the 1%, right? Like, it's the same idea, except it's in our industry and it's with a TV writing position. So that's why we've done now, I guess, 3 episodes, if you can, this one just talking about the evolution of access, the fact that less TV or more TV rather may mean less opportunity just because there's more content being produced, just because there's more episodes being made, doesn't mean that there's more credits being distributed. It doesn't mean more people are being hired. It's maybe one person writing half a season, especially when it's a season of 6 episodes. Rarely will you see a cable show with 6 episodes have a room of 6 people, right? In fact, my last show was probably double that amount of episodes, and we had half of the amount of people. And so if you think about it, that's the way the industry is moving forward, as opposed to the guild realizing, hold on, we can't just hoard all the credits at the top. We need to give more opportunities at the bottom. We need to create more jobs and enforce those positions that exist at every level. And to circle back to that email we got moments ago in terms of assistant work and so forth, that's why I'm a bit reticent to advise people to take writer's assistant positions or script coordinator positions with the goal of staffing, because those positions are amazing to learn the ins and outs of how writer's room work. In fact, I advise people should take those positions for that alone. The realistic person in me, the pragmatist, believes that those positions, in fact, are leading less and less towards upward mobility because there's fewer staff writer and up positions available for them, so they get stuck in that writer's assistant level. In the same way that you have countless of staff writers repeating the staff writer positions over and over again.
Yeah, and I think, like Alex said, this does come down to the WGA having to take a stand at some point and mandate lower level positions in rooms, perhaps put in some sort of guidelines as to how many years someone can remain at the same rank before they have to kind of be forced to basically be promoted, or what that happens to be, you know, some sort of restrictions around these little mini rooms and these non-rooms that now exist. Something needs to be done in the same way as they've just taken amazing action against the agencies to protect writers. This is the next sort of existential threat to the health of the TV writing industry.
Well, on this Debbie Downer, we'll see what happens. Hopefully the guild does something. I mean, I definitely believe that the guild should step in at some point. I'm very skeptical they will in the immediate future, just because obviously they have other priorities ahead of them. But at least it's good that people are talking about it, even though, like I said, this is the 3rd episode that we've talked about on this very topic in 3 years. So hopefully people will start to listen at some point.
All right. Well, on the topic of TV news, one of the really big things to come out recently is the Paramount Plus presentation going over all of the amazing new content that they're going to be coming out with under their various studios and networks and production companies. And a couple of these have gotten people very excited.
Yeah, it was an interesting presentation. It reminded me a bit of Disney's own presentation. I believe it was at the top of this year or end of last year when they did a whole reveal of all their slate. Well, Paramount Plus basically did that with all of their different IPs and so forth. They announced things that kind of leaked beforehand in the press. So it's kind of funny to see, like Frasier, for example. We already knew that Frasier was going to be having a revival. So them revealing that was less of a reveal. Like always, they also hid some trailers for certain things. So for example, the Dexter revival, instead of showing the teaser, they kind of just mentioned it and reserved that trailer for the investors as opposed to the audience, which is a bit weird, but okay. But overall, it's interesting to see where Paramount Plus is headed. I know we talked about it last month in our last paper scraps about how it's just another service and it's going to be hard for them to position themselves against all the other ones, because Paramount, even though it has the brand of the movie studio, it's not quite the same thing as HBO or Netflix or Disney that already have that brand for IP. And Paramount, even though it has some IP, most people are not familiar with Paramount and associating that with some of the shows they're showing.
Yeah, I think overall it was a smart move to incorporate it under a broader brand like that. CBS All Access always sounded a little bit kind of niche to me. Perhaps, you know, CBS resonates with an older audience a little bit more when they were trying to put so much younger fare in there, like Star Trek and everything. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. But I think one of the biggest news that kind of took people up in a whirlwind was the announcement of Avatar Studios, which is the studio that is now going to be in charge of the entire Avatar, The Last Airbender, Korra, etc., expanded universe. There's currently an animated feature in production right now. The two people who are heading up this studio underneath Ramsey Naito at Nickelodeon Animation are two of the original creators of Avatar, Michael DiMartino and Brian Konietzko. So they are going to be overseeing that whole universe and doing a lot more content in that world, which I think got a lot of people very excited.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that it took them almost two decades for them to realize the potential of this as a franchise, when I'm sure all the fans all over the world were like, this is a franchise. Pretty much every IP now is going to be a franchise. Pretty much every IP now is going to be some sort of universe, I feel like. And to that point, I also feel like a lot of Paramount Plus's content is reboots of old movies. Like they are doing, I think, a Flashdance TV show. I'm sure it's only a matter of time before there's a Mission Impossible TV show that's a spinoff of the Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah, it certainly begs the question of when is this kind of obsession with IP going to kind of have its bubble burst, if ever. I guess, you know, if people keep coming and watching and giving them their money, then maybe it won't. But there certainly is a strong desire in the creative community, I think, for original ideas for TV shows and movies to be considered again on equal footing with all of that and give us a chance to create new franchises and IP for you in the first place.
Absolutely. That's why it's a bit disheartening to see sort of the same reboots happening over and over again. And you can tell it's not necessarily a nostalgia bait, because the potential audience for some of those shows are not the people that grew up watching, for example, Flashdance or Grease. And it's also weird to see how the gap between the end of a show and its revival is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Dexter is an example of that. iCarly, that's another example. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of other franchises that barely just ended that are going to get a reboot pretty soon. In fact, CSI is another example of those constant revivals of relatively recent shows that just ended and are getting a revival, because why not? And speaking of shows that may or may not be rebooted at some point, Lost is about to celebrate its 11th year since its series finale. I think it's almost 20 years or something like that since premiere 2004. Are we not old yet? Anyway, so there was this whole Vulture old history about the series finale of Lost that just got published. That was pretty interesting. They talked to pretty much everybody, all the major players involved, obviously all the actors, but also Carlton Cuse, Lindelof, Liz Sarnoff, a bunch of the other EPs like Kitsis, Josh Holloway, obviously the actors, Jimmy Kimmel also, who's a huge Lost fan, a bunch of people involved in the crafting of that series finale, which is still relatively controversial despite hindsight.
Yeah, there's been a number of these kind of oral history of such and such, whether it's a particular episode of TV or a whole show or whatever that have come out. And they've always been really fascinating insights into a little bit of behind the scenes and the reaction at the time. Definitely worth checking out.
Especially if you are interested in polarizing thoughts about the Lost finale. I'm sure many of our listeners are thinking, oh my God, the Lost finale is amazing, or it's utter crap. It's a little bit like a Schrodinger's Lost.
I'm looking forward to the oral history of Game of Thrones in a few years.
Oh Lord, do you think they're going to actually be making this?
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe the new show will change people's perception.
All right, we'll see.
Maybe they'll do an oral history of the Paper Team podcast at some point. You know, we'll lobby for that.
We won't be interviewed. We won't be famous enough. It'll be all of our listeners being interviewed.
Yeah, the ones who have gone on to great success. So on that note, thank you to our listeners for taking the time to tune in to our nonsense.
You can get all the show notes for this episode at paperteam.co/211. I'm sometimes on Twitter at TV Calling.
And I'm at @NJWatson.
If you ever have thoughts about this podcast or questions you want to ask us, you can send them to ask@paperteam.co. That's C-O. And what are we doing next week?
Next week, you'll definitely want to tune in. We have a special announcement about the podcast, and we'll be filling you more in then. So check it out.
All right. See you next week.
See you then.